you. Thanks so much. It's a real privilege to be here. I'm wondering if my reputation has gone ahead of me, and that's why there's nobody sitting in this part. Had a bit of a challenge getting here this morning, and so had to walk across the muddy turf in order to get to this venue. And, you know, I kind of feel, you know, I was told that I was coming to Galilee, and I kind of feel as if I tried to part the waters, but they didn't part for me. So, you know, I'm feeling a bit soggy at the bottom here. I'm a Bible teacher, so what I want to do is to talk about transformative leadership by way of storying, and by way of storying the biblical text. And, you know, the Bible is very much full of stories of people who transformed their environments and transformed those who were closest to them and transformed the communities around them. And however far back we go in the biblical record, we witness both men and women who were powerfully used by God to bring about change and transformation. Some of those will include amongst the men people like Abraham, who was someone through whom God said that all the nations and all peoples would be blessed. And Moses is another individual who eventually rose from the task of shepherding a few sheep through the wilderness to shepherding an entire nation through the wilderness. David, too, graduated from fighting lions and bears in defense of a few sheep to felling a giant in defense of God's name and God's people, Israel. Then, of course, there are women like Deborah, who served her people by judging their disputes and prophesying their victories and leading them into battle. And who can forget Esther, who overcame her personal fears and doubts and challenges in order to save her people from genocide, and then went further than that by elevating them to a position of respect and security throughout the ancient world. I want to point us to another transformative leader, somebody who's not often thought of in leadership terms today. And we find the text that speaks about her in John's Gospel, chapter 4, from verse 39 to 42 in particular. But we get a better sense of her story when we read the whole text from John chapter 4, from verse 4. And this passage is entitled, in my version, Jesus Talks with a Samaritan Woman. And I just want you to hear the story. If you have the text in front of you, follow with me, but just hear the story. It says, now he, Jesus, had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his flocks and herds?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but those who drink the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go and call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know. For salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the Spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, am he." Just then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with the woman, but no one asked, "What do you want?" or "Why are you talking with her?" Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, "Come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?" They came out of the town and made their way toward him. Verse 39 of chapter 4. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. "He told me everything I ever did." So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them. And he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world." This is the longest ever recorded conversation that Jesus has with anyone in the biblical text. And he has this conversation with this unnamed woman. A conversation that eventually leads to the most remarkable description of community transformation in the New Testament. Jesus' interaction with this Samaritan woman, otherwise known as the woman at the well, reveals key principles, I believe, about transformative leadership. And I want to look at the text through the lens of leadership, and particularly transformative leadership. Not only are there aspects of this woman's life that resonate with our humanity, for those of us who are longing to exercise a more transformative influence, more transformative leadership, there are also lessons to be learned here. And I want to glean 5 principles for transformative leaders from the story of Jesus and the woman at the well. The first principle is simply this: a great name is not a prerequisite for great leadership. We often make the mistake when we come to the biblical text or even in life in general that just because a character or an individual is unnamed or their name is not well known, we believe that that person is somehow unimportant or is insignificant or is ordinary in some way. But the reality is that in God's kingdom, the cross turns the economy of the world on its head. And the named characters we find in the Bible are often depicted as the central characters, those who are central to God's purposes in a way that marginal characters are not. And yet when we move towards the margins of the biblical text, we find that they are crammed full of extraordinary people. In the margins, we often meet the unnamed followers of Jesus, the poor, the women, the children, those followers who are quietly getting on with acting on their faith, exercising leadership often, and being praised by God and Jesus as a result. We often find the most extraordinary faith and insight exercised by the so-called insignificant and marginal characters in a way we don't often see amongst the central characters. See, as marginal as they are, particularly in the New Testament, the named disciples are often depicted as being overly concerned with success and power measured in worldly terms. We not only catch them arguing about who will sit at Jesus' right hand or fumbling over their inability to deliver a demonized person, we also see them receiving rebukes on and on from Jesus himself. On the other hand, we see the most extraordinary and unqualified praise reserved for the unnamed, the poor, the women, the children, and the ethnically and sometimes theologically suspect characters in the text. Even before we really get into her story, this nameless woman, this unnamed leader, challenges us to take hold of an extraordinary truth, that a great name is seldom a prerequisite for greatness before God. The second principle for transformative leaders is this: we lead from who we are and who we're becoming. And who we're becoming is often determined by decisions we make in the most defining moments of our lives. There are many things that inspire and propel leaders to do what they do. But few things are as motivational as the encounters, as the defining encounters that we have either with individuals or with groups, and sometimes even with difficult and challenging circumstances. Each of these things have the power to inspire us to catch a vision of a future that God is wanting to make manifest, often the future that we're not seeing at this present moment in time. My own life is full of defining moments. These include my call to faith, my call to leadership as a woman, as Malcolm said. Yes, I need to get that name right. As Malcolm said, my call to leadership as a woman in a context that was often hostile to the concept of women in leadership, and often still is. And also a later crisis of faith and identity that I experienced when I had to ask the question, what did it mean to be young? Because I was then, and single, and black, and female, in a context that was generally unsympathetic to all of these distinctives. And each of these defining moments triggered in me a shift in perception and a shift in perspective and direction, both as an individual, but also as a leader. Each of these moments brought me face to face with myself, which is what happens actually, when we truly come face to face with Jesus, when we truly come face to face with God. We'll see that even as we continue to follow the story of the woman at the well. We lead from who we are and from who we're becoming. So who we're becoming matters. For the Samaritan woman, her encounter with Jesus was undoubtedly the most foundational and formative encounter of her life up until that point. For this woman, her defining moment occurred when she ventured out, perhaps as usual, to fetch water. But she went out at a very unusual time of day. In her culture, as in many cultures even today, women would normally go to fetch water during the morning, the evening, the coolest parts of the day. But this woman ventured out in the hottest part of the day. She went out at noon to fetch water. The time when other people would not have been present. The time when other women would not have been congregating around the well, exchanging news and gossip as they did so. By venturing out at noon when the heat of the sun was strongest, it becomes very clear that for some reason this Samaritan woman, this woman at the well, as we come to know her, was at the very least avoiding interaction with other women. In other words, she was ensuring that she would neither be seen or need to engage in the usual conversation and banter and gossip that went along with being with the other women at the well. Now, the text doesn't specify why she went about fetching water in this way. Some scholars suggest she was avoiding her community because she had been excluded by them. And the popular reading, which is interestingly not directly supported by the text, is that this woman was an outcast, a woman of dubious morals, and therefore someone on the margins of her community. In other words, this was not someone who could have been or would have been or should have been perhaps considered leadership material. Whatever the case may be, something happens to her during her interaction to come with Jesus that changes everything. In fact, she's so changed by the encounter that she eventually runs off in the direction of the very people she'd been seeking to avoid only a few moments earlier. Her encounter with Jesus is so formative that she is transformed from a person who's trying to avoid others to a person willing to engage and influence them towards a better end. In this text, her need is apparently forgotten, and she almost comically abandons the reason she'd made the trip to the well in the first place, and in her haste leaves her all-important water jar behind. Almost immediately after the disciples return with the shopping, she hurries back into town with little or no thought for herself. If we're to embrace the suggestion of the scholars I mentioned earlier, we must conclude that she ran into town with little consideration for the suggestive looks, the innuendos, or disbelief she might face once she arrived and declared to any who would listen that she had just met a man up by the well who seemed to know her circumstances very completely, and they should also follow this man. There is something about an encounter with Jesus, not just the encounter when we make that first step of accepting and embracing Jesus as Lord and Savior, but any encounter that changes us into transformers. And I don't mean like in the movie either. There is something about any encounter with Jesus that can dispel our fears, enable us to overcome our timidity, and give us a sense of purpose, or instill in us a sense of courage, a courage that we've never experienced before. An encounter with Jesus brings peace in the face of a perfect storm, or enables us to bear false accusation or even persecution. If we let it, that encounter can push us beyond the limitations of our own personal constraints. This woman had a lot to contend with. She belonged to a society that limited and constrained her from both the outside as well as inside. In John's Gospel, chapter 4, verse 9, the Samaritan woman said to him, to Jesus, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." As a woman, the Samaritan at the well would have faced the sexism of both Jewish men and Samaritan men. In fact, the rabbis of her time had little sayings that betrayed the prevailing sentiments regarding women. Men were told that one should not talk, quote, one should not talk with a woman on the street, not even with his own wife, and certainly not with somebody else's wife, because of the gossip of men, unquote. It was also said that it is forbidden to give a woman any greeting. In John 4, verse 27, when the disciples discovered Jesus in conversation with this woman, the text informs us his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked, what do you want? Or why are you talking with her? They were surprised in the first instance, not because he was talking to a Samaritan. After all, they had just themselves gone into a Samaritan village to buy food. They were surprised first and foremost because Jesus was talking to a woman. And this was clearly not a one-way conversation. In other words, Jesus was giving her voice. Their surprise helps us to understand just how pervasive the prevailing prejudices of their day were. Some rabbis even taught that to teach your daughters the Torah was as inappropriate as selling them into prostitution. However, the prevailing prejudices against women are far from unique to Jesus' era. And many of the historical debates that the Anglicans are still talking about, surrounding, and the Baptists for that matter, surrounding women in leadership of any kind, have often relied upon the prevailing prejudices of the day. Many of the early theologians were strongly influenced by the thinking of early Greek philosophers such as Aristotle. He espoused a view that female nature was fundamentally flawed and defective and closer to nature than male nature, which was closer to God. So many hundreds of years later, Tertullian's insistence that women are the devil's gateway, or Saint Augustine's announcement that woman was merely man's helpmate and is not the image of God. But as far as man is concerned, he said, he himself is the image of God. All of this sounded pretty much like common sense, as does much of the prevailing prejudices of our day. And as time passes, they just sound common rather than sense. Now, although the disciples' main surprise was that they found Jesus in conversation with and giving voice to a woman. It could, of course, have been any woman. But the situation was made a great deal worse by the fact that this particular woman also happened to be a Samaritan. Samaritan women were not just discriminated against by Samaritan and Jewish men, but also by Jewish women. The prevailing attitude towards Samaritan women was summed up in another rabbinical statement. The daughters of the Samaritans are deemed unclean as menstruants from the cradle. And if you're wondering what that means, remember that in the Old Testament, women who were menstruating were kept outside the camp, outside of the community. She was a Samaritan who happened to be a woman, and a woman who happened to be a Samaritan, double jeopardy. And as a single woman in her culture, her social status would have been somewhere near the bottom of any existing class structure that may have been present. So let's make that triple jeopardy. You are a Jew. I am a Samaritan woman, she said. How can you ask me for a drink? In other words, Jews and Samaritans simply did not mix socially. Buying food was one thing, social exchange was something else entirely. We're told in the text, for Jews do not associate with Samaritans. It's better translated as, for Jews do not use dishes Samaritans have used. In fact, in this time, Jews had a long history of prejudice toward the Samaritans. A minority community, disempowered community, oppressing a disempowered community. The Jewish attitude to Samaritans is summed up in John 8:48. When Jesus is accused by the Pharisees of being a Samaritan, they say to him, aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed? And we need to understand that they didn't say that because they really believed he was a Samaritan. In verse 20 of John chapter 8, the same chapter, it makes it clear that Jesus was in the temple treasury at the time of the exchange, and Samaritans were forbidden to go there. So they were speaking to him as a way of demeaning him. in pretty much the same way that one culture makes demeaning jokes of another culture. By this period of Jewish history, Samaritans were thought of as the children of political rebels, racial half-breeds, whose religion was tainted by various unacceptable elements. In short and politely put, they were viewed as racially inferior and theologically dubious. The passage could just as well have been entitled, "Jesus Talks with a Racially Inferior Heretic at the Well." But then Jesus was always talking and speaking to the very people the establishment thought he shouldn't be speaking to. And through his actions, we see that Jesus enables the Samaritan woman to understand and appreciate her own value, what she had to offer, and who she could become. An encounter with Jesus makes us more the people we are created to be, because who we're becoming is important. It's important because transformative leaders lead out of who they are and who they are becoming. It's not just the unbeliever who needs an encounter with Jesus. We believers need encounters with Jesus that transform us over and over again and bring us face to face with God and ourselves over and over again, if we are to transform lives and communities. Unlike any other life-changing encounter a leader may have, an encounter with Jesus does more than overcome human constraints. It does more than enable us to correct and realign our perceptions. Encounters with Jesus also enable us to accomplish something of eternal value as leaders. And without these encounters, we would be no more than well-meaning humanists trying to do good based on our limited knowledge, limited human ideas, limited human energy and power. Don't get me wrong, we'd be good. We see the evidence of that all around us. We just wouldn't be that good. Political leaders generate legislation. Educational leaders generate useful knowledge. Business leaders generate jobs. Economists generate calculations. Sociologists generate helpful theory, and psychologists encourage self-understanding. But there is only one person that enables us to manifest the powers of the age to come, and it's Jesus. So the first principle of transformative leadership we learn from the Samaritan woman is this: a great name is not a prerequisite for great leadership. The second principle is this: we lead from who we are and who we're becoming. So who we're becoming is important. Life-changing encounters with Jesus that bring us face to face with God and ourselves help us to become agents of transformation. But as important as that is, an internal becoming is not enough. An encounter is not enough. Revelation is not enough. Conviction is not enough. True encounter leads to action. And the third principle of transformative leadership that we can take away from this story is quite simply, be willing to embrace initiative. Jesus sat down by the well, tired, depleted, hungry, and shortly afterwards, a Samaritan woman, apparently fully aware of the taboos that surrounded male and female interactions, and in spite of the animosity that existed between Jews and Samaritans, ventures into uncharted territory. Jesus sat by the well, and she boldly approached both the well and the unidentified Jewish man sitting beside it. She may have feared abuse at his hands, we don't know. But it seems that her need for water was so overwhelming that instead of retreating, she simply embraced initiative. She went ahead. If she hadn't trusted her instincts on that day, she may well have missed what we call a divine appointment. Much of the time, scholars emphasize the fact that Jesus broke a social taboo by speaking with this Samaritan woman. But of course, she also broke the same social taboo by firstly approaching the well and then by responding and engaging in the conversation with Jesus. It wasn't only men who were aware that they were not to speak with women. Women also were aware that they were not to speak and interact with men. Yet knowing what she knew, the Samaritan woman took the initiative. Not only did she respond to Jesus, she engaged him in conversation on her own terms and even discussed theology with him. And likewise, by engaging with the Samaritan woman, Jesus took the initiative and thereby challenged the racial and gender discrimination usually exercised by Jewish men. It's interesting that this woman found Jesus so unintimidating. And for those of us who are women in leadership, oftentimes we find ourselves in incredibly intimidating circumstances and sometimes made to feel intimidated. And she found Jesus so unintimidating, although she must have known that socially and culturally she was expected to treat this rabbi as her superior. Instead, it seems there was something about him that enabled her to engage, to challenge, to question, and even to debate. For example, when Jesus suggests that he can provide her with better water than the well she has access to, she challenges his integrity and demands to know if Jesus thinks he and the water he offers is better than her predecessor, Jacob, and the water from Jacob's well. And by engaging the Samaritan woman, Jesus challenges the ethnocentrism and the cultural and gender discrimination of the Jews, especially the men. By discussing theology with her, he challenged the assessment that she was no better than a heretic. Yet by questioning Jesus in the way she did, the Samaritan woman challenged the social and cultural expectation that a Samaritan woman's role should be one of deference to a Jewish male and a rabbi. She was simply herself with him. And without doubt, great leadership is personable and relational. Do people feel more themselves when you share with them? Do you put them at ease? Do they sense Jesus in you affirming them, or do they sense you judging them? See, the woman at the well was so at ease with Jesus. She felt so affirmed by him that she even allowed him to probe her lifestyle. Jesus' request, "Go call your husband and come back," in John 4:16-18, was not met with defensiveness and anxiety, but with frankness and honesty. "I have no husband," she replied, to which Jesus says, "That's quite true. You have had 5 husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband." Now, most commentators don't even try to make any real sense of her response, except to suggest, promiscuity. Or maybe prostitution. We don't generally delve more seriously into the question of why she had had 5 husbands and the man she now had was not her husband. Was the woman widowed? Was she divorced? Remember that in this society, men were at liberty to divorce their wives, but the opposite was not the case. It's not usually asked whether she was simply subject to the levirate custom, where a widow was seriously married off to the brothers of her dead husband, as Tamar was in Genesis 8. That would explain why she was hiding from the rest of the crowd. Yet Jesus quickly gets to the root of what must have been one of the most painful issues in her life, and she freely shares it without fear of condemnation or reproof. As she comes face to face with God, Jesus brings her face to face with herself. But he also brings her face to face with some of her most deeply held beliefs. "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you'll worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth. for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. To be in the presence of someone who can tell you the truth, challenge and correct without condemning or reproving is a remarkable experience. Transformative leaders need to be those kind of people. Taking the initiative is a key feature of this encounter. We see it in Jesus' actions. In fact, the extreme initiative that he takes in going one step further than any other encounter that he's had up until this point in the biblical text is that he reveals to this woman, this unnamed woman, this unnamed leader, his true identity as the promised Messiah. As I've already mentioned, she also takes the initiative with apparently no encouragement from Jesus. After this encounter, she races back into town in an attempt to persuade her fellow townspeople to come and meet a man who told me everything. There are many things and many people we meet in life that have the power to intimidate and constrain us from taking the initiative when it's in our power to do so. And sometimes these come from our communities, and sometimes from our churches, and sometimes from ourselves. Leadership means many things to many people, but at its baseline, it is at least about a willingness to take the initiative in the face of benign or hostile conditions. So the first principle of transformative leadership we learn from the Samaritan woman is this: a great name is not a prerequisite for great leadership. The second is this: we lead from who we are and who we're becoming. The third principle of transformative leadership is quite simply be willing to embrace initiative. And the fourth we glean from this passage is this: dare to be unconventional and innovative. In other words, dare to do what has not yet been done. In a society where women were illiterate and uneducated, we meet an innovative and unconventional woman. A woman who seems to be self-taught. How do we know that she's self-taught? Because John 4:19-24 tells us that she was familiar with the significance of Jacob's well and the differences of opinion that existed between Jewish and Samaritan views on the proper place and form of worship. In fact, she had thought about it long and hard enough to be able to argue the toss with Jesus when she realized he was a gifted prophet. Unconventional and innovative. Not at all what might be expected of a woman in her position. And of course, Jesus encouraged it, allowing her to question and to challenge the status quo, stretching her understanding still further and redirecting her when necessary. See, whereas taking the initiative is a willingness to lead without being prompted, being innovative is about daring to do what has not yet been done. Both Jesus and the Samaritan woman demonstrate the power of this. For her, it led to remarkable revelation and insight and release. No one had yet tried to preach the gospel to the Samaritans, even though they had common roots with the Jews. On the other hand, Jesus, innovative and unconventional, speaking to the least likely person possible. A Samaritan woman, and not just a Samaritan woman, but one in hiding, trying to avoid the rest of the crowd. And it's this Samaritan woman who was eventually used by God to transform Samaria. You know, in a world that says you're not the right size, you're not the right shape, you're not the right color, gender, or creed, you have the wrong nose for leadership, your lips are too thick, your style is all wrong, and your approach is a bit unorthodox. In such a world, this encounter inspired initiative taking innovative Samaritan woman is a breath of fresh air. And we all like a breath of fresh air, don't we? Even the green belt. She reminds us that God chooses whom he will and sometimes works through those we really don't think he ought to. We don't need to be just like anyone else or do things in the same way as the leader up the road or the one who lives down the motorway. Our task is to discern what the Spirit of God has planned for us and to embrace it. So the first principle of transformative leadership, a great name is not necessarily a prerequisite for great leadership. The second, we lead from who we are and who we're becoming. Who we're becoming is important. The third, be willing to embrace initiative. The fourth, dare to be unconventional and innovative. Dare to do what has not yet been done. And the final principle, you can breathe out, of transformative leadership is particularly critical in our era. Be community-minded. Never forget that this is not just about you. During the last century, the 20th century, for the first time in human history, global entities have emerged that are capable of impacting what no tribe or nation has been able to impact before. To create such a dramatic shift in the chemical balance in the atmosphere of our planet that we could simply end life as we know it. And without wanting to sound too Star Trek-y about it, either selfish individualism has a limited lifespan, or we do. In a chaotic era like ours, characterized by uncertainty and challenging social and economic climates, I believe our nation waits impatiently for men and women who, like the woman at the well, are not afraid to drop the things that appear most urgent so they can play their part in something far more important. And that's regardless of where we're positioned as leaders, whether we're in the church, whether we're in the community, whether we're in the marketplace. In John 4:28, we read, "Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, 'Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?' They came out of the town and made their way toward him." We often forget how difficult it was for women to be heard in Jesus' culture. So the speed and wholeheartedness of the townspeople's response is nothing short of a miracle. Take it from me. The testimonies of women were usually dismissed in New Testament society, and women of dubious morals were usually stoned or put out of their community. They were certainly not listened to and followed. And we're told that some believed just on the basis of what she said, even before they heard Jesus. You know, leadership is often measured by one's ability to influence others. This woman went into a town full of potentially hostile anti-Jewish Samaritans and managed to convince them that the Jewish guy up by the well was worth listening to and could even be the promised Messiah. If leadership is the ability to influence others towards a common goal, then what she did was to exercise extraordinary leadership. Booker T. Washington once commented, "I've learned that success is to be measured not so much by the position that one has reached in life as by the obstacles which he, she has had to overcome while trying to succeed." Something had changed in her heart. She was no longer shunning or wanting to avoid her people. Instead, literally moments after her encounter with Jesus, she's committed to doing them good. Her first thought after having been blessed by Jesus was, "How can I bless others?" And her behavior challenges us to remember that although transformative leadership begins in us, it's not just about us, and neither is it primarily for us. In fact, it's not even primarily for the benefit of our family or church community. It's for the benefit of the whole community. And in a globalized context, what each person recognizes our whole community needs to keep growing. We need to recognize how much we impact people who are light years, as it were, from us. It reminds us that our relationship with Jesus should at least prompt us to make a difference in the communities we do engage in. Our friends, our neighbors, our colleagues, the people we interact with every day. But the story of the Samaritan woman is also avowedly evangelical. Because it reminds us that it's one thing for people to encounter us. It's quite another thing for people to encounter Jesus. We're told that many of the Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. Fantastic. He told me everything I ever did, she said. Our testimony is powerful, but it's not enough. So she still had to lead the townspeople to the well to meet Jesus himself. They said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we've heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world." If our exercise of leadership, wherever we're placed, benefits only me, myself, and I, it's not transformative. Transformative leadership is other. It's community-focused. And the larger we perceive the community to be, the better. Transformative leaders feel prompted to go to places where they may endure suggestive looks, innuendo, and frank disbelief. Because transformative leaders recognize that a great name is not a prerequisite for great leadership. That they must lead from who they are and who they're becoming. That they need to be willing to embrace initiative and dare to be unconventional and innovative. And lastly, transformative leaders are community-minded. They never forget that this is not just about them. Our nation needs believers who are prepared to set aside the personally urgent, drop the water jar, in order to deal with the collective important. There is a future God is seeking to make manifest, and transformative leaders are seeking it too. This Samaritan woman is not simply the first person Jesus reveals his identity as Messiah to. She's also the first recorded evangelist we encounter in the New Testament. As we read through the book of Acts, we learn that by the time Philip arrived in Samaria, most of the Samaritans had become followers of Jesus. It seems that the Samaritan at the well discovered her calling and simply got on with the job. And for some of us, women in leadership, that's what we've got to do. Discover the calling and get on with the job. Consequently, she's credited with the evangelization of the whole region of Samaria. She reminds us that God invests in, engages with, and affirms and commissions whom he will, and particularly those on the margins of society. After her baptism, the Samaritan woman came to be known as Photina, which means radiant or shining one. How appropriate. She also occupies a place of honor within the Greek Orthodox community among their apostles. She's said to have traveled widely from Africa to Rome with her 5 daughters and 2 sons, transforming the communities wherever God directed them. And eventually, this family paid the ultimate price through martyrdom. A great name is not a prerequisite for great leadership. We will lead from who we are and who we're becoming. We must be willing to embrace initiative and dare to be unconventional and innovative. And lastly, as transformative leaders, we must be community-minded. Never forget that this is not just about me. That's transformative leadership. We have little time, so we can take some questions.
I have a mic, so if you want to ask questions, it might be easier if people sort of like come to me rather than me just sort of like wandering around. That way we can get through more questions and give Kate more time to answer them. Thanks.
Hi, Kate. I'm a fellow Baptist, and I think you've got this amazing gift from God that every time you speak, you go to the New Testament, you go back to the Old Testament, and it's like a journey. Lately, I've been studying the Old Testament, and I'm an Old Testament junkie. But I've been studying through a study guide that is designed by the Catholics. Absolutely no problem with that, just that the denomination that I grew up in was very strict and very... just a challenge for you? Can you look into, maybe through the Evangelical Alliance, or into having a method of studying the Old Testament and the New Testament together that is actually beyond the empty certainties of denominations? Because the problem I've got with what I'm studying now, it's absolutely beautiful, but I have to close my eyes to my ears to the papacy and stuff like that because of my background. So can I challenge you that you have a look into what I'm having, something that will work for everybody, because it's all about God and Jesus rather than the small denomination and we're all separate? Thank you. Just a small challenge for you.
Wow. Okay, that's a small challenge. Well, okay, I consider myself challenged. I do want to say one thing about that, that there is something powerful about studying the text from the perspective of different sort of denominational lenses. And I have found that powerful. But I think you have to be aware that that's what you're doing. And oftentimes people aren't aware of that. They come to the text and come to a particular study guide and say, okay, this is the final word on the subject. And actually, the fact that there are so many perspectives means that we need to take the perspectives into consideration when we're coming to the text and realize that oftentimes different groups have different pieces of the puzzle. So, yeah, I hear that. I hear your heart in that. I've also felt that frustration. I consider myself challenged. I might pass that, delegate that like a good leader on to somebody else.
My question is, how do you cope with the anger that comes up when you are being an initiated leader, a woman in leadership, but you face so much shit coming back at you? How do you cope with the anger that goes with that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Have some really good friends you can just puke up on from time to time. Seriously, because the stuff really can make you feel sick. And you need friends who are mature enough not to say, yes, take the pin out of the hand grenade and toss it in. You know, you need friends who are mature enough to say, okay, you've got all of that out. Are you ready for action now? So you do need people you can actually say absolutely anything to and just get it all out. And you need to do that regularly. Otherwise, it does, literally, it can make you sick. Yeah, yeah. I hope that helps. Yeah.
What you have said about that passage is fantastic. It's inspirational. There's one little bit that always sort of hits me in the stomach when I read it, which you didn't address. And I think it might be a personal thing. I'm the only adult in my household, and it's when I get a workman in, and they're giving me a quote, and I'm arguing, because I do, and he says, I need to speak to your husband. When I read that bit, I think either, if we take how you interpreted the next bit, was Jesus asking a trick question, in which case, that's not how my Jesus communicates, or was he doing what my workmen do, which irritates me so intensely. I even had one recently when I said, there is no husband, said, what about your dad?
I'm tempted to ask where you live and just to say avoid that area. I've had to face that sort of thing as well from time to time myself. And I think for many women, particularly if you're single and, you know, you have to get on with stuff by yourself, when people kind of relate to you in that way as if somehow you're infantile and you can't think for yourself, it can be very destroying. I hear what you're saying about the text and seeing that in the text, and obviously that's something that really resonates with you in a negative way. So seeing that there, it's very easy to interpret in that way. I don't see it in that way. I see it very much as Jesus saying, I know about you. I know your circumstances. I know what's going on for you. But I want you to know that I know. And I find that a very releasing thing. coming from where I've come from, particularly, I think, as a black woman in leadership, because oftentimes you find you're having to explain yourself and explain why you feel a certain way or why you do things in a particular way. And just to have somebody say, actually, I know what's going on. I know what's happened for you. I know, you know, I just want you to know that I know. And that's how I have seen the text, but I hear what you're saying. I need to think a little bit more about that. Thanks for that.
Hi, Kate. Hiya. We talk about transformational leadership, and often when we do, we talk about women being transformational leadership, and it seems to be easier. That's the feeling that comes out of the studying that I've done, for women to be transformational than it is for men, and that it's not as natural for women to be hierarchical than it might be, say, for men. Do you have any comments about the sex issue, about women, men, transformational, male transformational leaders?
Yeah, I mean, I think men are just as capable of being transformational leaders as women are. I think one of the things that enables women to perhaps be in this season, in this era, to be more transformational is that they've often had to try to exercise their leadership outside of the norms of leadership and the accepted norms of leadership. And so they've had to be more innovative and more creative about how they exercise their leadership. And also because the traditional formats of leadership, which are largely masculine, have been very much hierarchical in focus. Having said that, that's not the case for younger men. Younger men tend to be shifting away from that very sort of command-control approach to leadership and that sort of very hierarchical approach to leadership. And it's a facet of leadership in our times. But women do come to that much more easily because they've been generally excluded from the hierarchy. So they've tended to operate and to seek leadership styles and approaches that are non-hierarchical and feel much more comfortable in that. And so the innovation often flows out of that context. Does that help? Yeah. So yes is the answer to that, and no. Okay, yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Kate. That was a fantastic talk. And I think we all should show our appreciation.